Good afternoon. Welcome to all of our members and guests here today and to those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 475th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. It comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look. Since its founding over 40 years ago, the forum has been hearing from an invited speaker each month on an issue central to U.S. foreign policy. You can listen to audios of past forum talks and get information about upcoming forum speakers on our website, midcoastforum.org. Recent forum talks are also on the websites of Maine Public Radio and the Maine Monitor. If you're interested in staying informed about key foreign affairs issues, please consider becoming a forum member. And that's true of those of you who are guests here today as well. We'd love to have you as a member. Our membership form is on the forum's website. It's easy to fill out. All you have to do is that and send in your membership fee, and you become a member of the forum. We are pleased to have Mr. Clark Adams with us today to speak on defense diplomacy in Central Asia. Clark Adams served as a director for Central Asian Affairs in the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from January 2007 until his retirement in February earlier this year. He and his team were responsible for the management of U.S. defense relations with Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. In spring of 2008, he was temporarily detailed to the National Security Council to serve as a director for Central Asian Affairs, where he was responsible for all matters related to U.S. relations with these five Central Asian states. Previously, Mr. Adams held the Defense Department position of Director for U.S. Capabilities Development. His portfolio there included implementing the U.S. Department of Defense Directive on Military Support to Security, Stabilization, Transition, and Reconstruction Operations, which, you know, has received a lot of more emphasis in the last couple of decades. And how do we reconstruct, not just go in and fight wars, et cetera, but reconstruct those areas of the world where conflicts have occurred. Mr. Adams also held the position of Deputy Director in the DoD Non-Proliferation Policy Office. In this role, he was the Secretary of Defense representative to the Missile Technology Control Regime, Nuclear Suppliers Group, and the Australia Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons. And all of those are essential to our non-proliferation policies. He also worked on regional issues such as North Korean missile proliferation, Chinese non-proliferation controls, and strategic cooperation with India. And early in his government career, he worked security assistance and foreign military sales, weapon systems export policies, international defense cooperation, and intelligence issues. Mr. Adams has a Master of Science in National Security Strategy from the National War College, and a Bachelor of Science in Economics and Political Science, and a Master of Arts in International Relations, both from the Pennsylvania State University. Clark, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the kind introduction, George. It's a real pleasure to be here to talk to the Foreign Policy Forum. I was telling George and some of the board members last night that Department of Defense has regional centers. They are groups that essentially quasi-academic that deal with seminars for foreign government officials, courses on different topics related to national security for foreign government officials, and two of them are located in really choice places. One is the George C. Marshall Center, which is located in Garmisch-Partenkirchen in Germany. The other is the Daniel Inouye Indo-Pacific Center, which is located in Honolulu, Hawaii. Interestingly enough, neither center ever has trouble attracting speakers. If it's in Omaha, Nebraska, sorry if there are any Nebraskans here, but it's a lot harder to get them to come out. So I actually think that an invitation to speak in Maine is equally hard to resist, and when it came up, I could not pass it up. So as George introduced me, just I kind of want to frame this because the topic of today's briefing is to me is a really fascinating one. I mentioned to one of your colleagues just a little while ago that I loved working the Central Asia portfolios. I happened to come into the job right when we were at a critical moment in our operations in Afghanistan, and it was probably the most rewarding work that I got it to be able to do in my career because it had direct operational impact for our forces in the field. And it really was a wonderful job, and you know, these are the kind of things you feel good about. I'll take it a quick aside here. Last night, we were also talking with some board members about kind of what it's like to work in the Pentagon, and I told them a joke about early on in my career riding on a metro train and coming into the Pentagon station, and there was a cheeky conductor who was announcing the stations, and he goes, "Pentagon," and then he goes, "How many people do you think work in the Pentagon?" And there was this pregnant pause, and he goes, "About half of them." And and I'm thinking to myself, okay, is this something that I want to be associated with? As George and Eric can both tell you, though, it's the last thing from the truth. The building is a very intense work environment. The people who work there are highly motivated by their mission set, by what they're trying to accomplish. And the work hours are long and rather thankless sometimes, but the reward is actually getting to work on something that has substantive impact for the country. DoD is a pretty enormous enterprise. Its budget this coming year, $840-850 billion, depending on how that shakes out. 2 million uniformed personnel, 775 about 1,000 civilians basically across the system. So it's an enormous enterprise. When you get to the Pentagon, the number of civilians compresses very quickly, and you're down to organizations or elements with several hundred people in them, as well as uniformed military people who support the service chiefs, as well as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. My organization, the one that George worked in, the one that Eric worked in, is the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And that role, it's a small organization, 300-400 people, depending on how you count them, that serves as the SecDef's, I'll use that acronym, Secretary of Defense, pretty obvious, is the SecDef's primary advisor on all aspects of defense policy. And it takes the full range from regional organizations, arms control, special operations, cyber policy, space policy, strategy development, force development, whole range of different issues. So it's one of the most intense positions you can imagine, certainly in Washington. I think it is also the primary focal point within the DoD bureaucracy for interactions with what we call the interagency, with the State Department, the CIA, the National Security Council staffs, who sit down and basically hash through issues. As issues come up, challenges come up, we basically have to work with those other agencies. And I know George, when I knew George, we were doing non-proliferation work. Eric, we were working on Pakistan, and we were doing Pakistan policy. And the people that we worked with generally were defense professionals. They're people who transitioned, as you saw from kind of my bio, have done a range of different things. And that's how most people in the organization develop over their careers, to become expert in national security issues and defense policy issues, as opposed to being kind of specialized or focused experts. So it's a bit unusual that I worked the portfolio that I did for as long as I did. And it was, as I mentioned, it was largely because it was one of the most rewarding things that I'd worked on and really felt I was making a substantive contribution. So understand that today, you know, I'm talking to you as a defense professional, or rather a former defense professional, not as a professional diplomat, not as a uniformed military expert, or not as an academic or a Central Asian academic expert. I am sure some of you looked at the title of this presentation and kind of thought, defense diplomacy, what exactly does that mean? And of course, now you're sitting there and going, why is this guy who wasn't uniformed and wasn't a foreign service officer, why is he talking to us about defense diplomacy? The reason is that while the State Department has primacy in the foreign policy sphere, and that's something you just need to take away, is we've got a lot of different players in the process, but the Secretary of State and the State Department still ultimately is the primary player, the primary advisor to the president on foreign policy and national security issues. So their portfolios are very broad, everything from trade promotion, negotiating all forms of international agreements, trade deals, WMD proliferation issues, interactions with the United Nations and other international organizations. So, you know, the defense component of it is one thing that when you go over to the State Department, they're trying to balance a whole range of issues, a whole range of U.S. diplomatic objectives and goals. But, as I mentioned, the Department of Defense is an enormous entity, and it's an entity with global reach. It is probably one of the most visible aspects of the U.S. government and the United States when you get overseas. The Department of Defense depends on having good relationships with countries all around the world because of this question about global reach. And one of the things I wanted to get into in today's presentation is give you a sense of kind of some of the challenges that we have to factor in to how we approach our relationships overseas. We have to be able to move personnel, equipment, support materials to locations halfway around the world and basically at a moment's notice. That kind of mobility requirement means that we have to have cooperation from governments all around the world. And you just don't go fly aircraft wherever you want. It's an act of war in some places. It's a violation of a country's sovereignty. So you need to get countries' permission. You need to get countries' permission to bring naval vessels into their ports to be able to fly over their territory, to be able to bring military personnel for combined operations. These things all require the host governments to want to work with us. So access for our forces, you know, basing of ships, the ability to overfly, navigation through territorial waters is obviously critical for us. We have agreements we call SOFAs, which are status of forces agreements. We have those with a lot of countries around the world. And it provides things like the ability to overfly their territory, the ability to use ports and military facilities in their countries, but also how American personnel are treated in their legal systems. And unfortunately, bad things happen sometimes, accidents, crimes, and we have to be able to protect U.S. personnel when they're overseas. So being able to get these agreements is really, really critical to us, and that's because we look at the world through what I call a physics and geography lens. It's basically saying, you know, you have to move things to a place, you have to move people to a place. It's not something you can write a memo about and just basically wish problems away. So this question about, you know, moving things is sometimes a situation that gets you into very black and white situations. It's either on or it's off. The country says yes, the country says no, and the implications of a country saying no can have significant impact for us. The other piece of it is because of the visibility of U.S. military, host governments also want to work with the U.S. military. And they do that for a variety of reasons. One is the symbolism of working with the U.S. Another thing is basically it's in their national security interest to have good partnerships with us in most parts of the world. And that means that our military relationships fit back into that State Department broad diplomatic toolbox that I was talking about. And we use military relations sometimes to advance other objectives in country-to-country relations. So that's what we start talking about, defense diplomacy. That's what that means. We also have what we call regional combatant commanders. They are essentially responsible for areas of the world. We have a combatant commander for Indo-PACOM, which covers the whole Pacific region, EUCOM, which covers all of the European countries and Russia. We have AFRICOM, which covers Africa, obviously, CENTCOM, which has the whole Middle East region. These, SOUTHCOM, which covers South America, I think I mentioned, these commands all are visible faces of the United States, and these combatant commanders travel regularly through their regions and through their countries to basically emphasize our interest in maintaining contact with them and working with them. We also very often use visits by senior defense officials, like the Secretary of Defense, for instance, traveling to multiple countries. Every time you see pictures of Secretary Austin in a different part of the world, think about, you know, why is he there? It's not just because they wanted to go on a trip. He went to a region, or he goes to a region, to make particular statements, to give particular signals to adversaries and to partner nations. His travel schedule is one of the most hotly debated issues that we have in the policy organization, because everybody's fighting for very limited bandwidth. They travel out to, and getting a SecDef visit. He lands in a country normally in what's called an E-4B. It's one of the doomsday planes. It's a modified 747, enormous aircraft. United States of America slapped on the side of it. And when that lands in a different country and pulls up in an airport or a foreign capital, it sends a strong message to both, you know, regional partners and adversaries. So now the Central Asia piece, and I'd like to say kind of how we applied, this is a little case study in how we applied defense diplomacy to achieve a very important objective for us in Afghanistan. And I want to just underscore that the lessons from this case study can apply pretty much any place in the world. And if you think about why we have relations with governments in different parts of the world that sometimes are unsavory, we have issues with them, we have political challenges, human rights challenges, but we still have to work with those countries. It's often because of those physics and geography challenges that we have to work with them. So, Central Asia. I know that you had Ambassador Laura Kennedy came up and talked to you about Central Asia, and she kind of gave you an overview of the region. You can't talk about Central Asia without a map. It's not a part of the world where most people can reasonably expect to know where it is, what the countries are, kind of what the environment is like to work in without having a map. And I know that Laura talked to you about kind of U.S. goals in the Central Asia region broadly for the U.S., or energy issues, promoting democratic norms, advancing human rights, creating trade opportunities, regional border security, non-proliferation. There are a whole range of issues that she addressed and mentioned to you. I won't delve into those things, but keep in mind those range of issues when we're talking about the defense challenge. When you look at this map of Central Asia, geography is everything. For the purpose of this discussion, we're talking about the five Central Asian republics, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, and how they fit into the broader regions. I want you to keep three things in mind. First is, these countries are all landlocked. And that means that transportation into and out of the region is extremely complicated. And just a quick quiz for you from Laura's presentation. There's one other double landlocked country in Central Asia, Uzbekistan. That means two countries to get to an ocean. What's the other one in the world? Does anybody remember? No? Liechtenstein. So And the next time you guys have a Jeopardy quiz, you can say, I heard it at the Foreign Policy Forum, and that's how I know it. The second thing to remember is this is a really tough neighborhood. If you look at the region, Central Asia is bordered by Iran, Russia, China, Pakistan, Afghanistan. There's nothing easy there. There's no easy math when you start talking about this part of the world. And the three connected to that, that without the cooperation of Russia, China, Iran, or Pakistan, the only way that you can get into and out of the region is if you look right there, if you look on the map and you see the Caucasus basically through Georgia and Azerbaijan, that's the only way that you can get into the region if you don't have cooperation from those other neighboring states. It's the only other way that you can get there. And that figures prominently in kind of the challenge that we had to work through to support operations in Afghanistan. Just a couple other things is that between 1991 and 2001, most of our interactions with these former Soviet republics was focused on trying to help them get away from the Soviet military model. That means things like professional military education to get them to move away from rote memorization of military tactics and doctrine and move into a more critical thinking mode. That's one of the strengths, for instance, of the US military is that our lower level personnel are given a great deal of authority and autonomy, but it requires them to be able to think quickly and critically to be able to move. Development of non-commissioned officer corps, which is related to that same topic, an important one, civilian control of the military. In all these governments, it was, you know, the generals basically run all the things related to defense and national security policy. Our model, you want civilians running that, and the uniforms basically are there to provide their best military advice as professionals. That's it, and that's a critical difference in the way our system works. Last thing was adopting, you know, Western, global, international human rights standards, is trying to teach these militaries that there are better ways to operate and that they don't require, you know, the heavy hand that many of them were trained to use to be able to deal with situations. So between 91, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and September 11th, 2001, those were the things we were focused on. Everything changed on September 11th, and suddenly the United States had to figure out how it was going to be able to mount an attack against the Taliban from halfway around the world. And just so you know, about 7,000 miles from Washington, D.C. to Kabul, 10 time zones, it's a long way to go. So it's not just physically difficult to get there, but it is also really just on the opposite side of the planet. We would often joke in the office, there was a movie from the 80s called The Princess Bride. I'm sure some people saw it, right? Well, there were a lot of good quotes from that movie, but one of the favorite ones that we used as we were trying to work through this problem set, and I'll just read it directly to you. You fool, you fell victim to one of the classic blunders, the most famous of which is never get involved in a land war in Asia. I had colleagues who actually had that quote hanging up in their offices because of the challenge, but it was so true. As I mentioned, this gave us a real physics and geography problem, and it had to be solved very quickly. And when we started to look at the map, we realized that we really didn't have many good options other than going through Central Asia. Pakistan would have been too complicated, and obviously the other neighbors wouldn't work. So this is just a little article clip from the Guardian, which reported out on a trip by Secretary Rumsfeld out to the region to basically quickly negotiate basing access so that we would be able to take the initial actions against the Taliban. And it was the first step in what I would call the defense diplomacy process that we worked. And we ended up with these three locations. If you can look at the map, you'll see a star close to Tashkent in Uzbekistan. That's for the Kashnikanabad Air Base. You'll see one near Dushanbe in Tajikistan. That is the Kulyab Air Base. And then you will see another star up in Kyrgyzstan near Bishkek, and that was the Manas Air Base. It was originally named the Gansi Air Base after the New York firefighting captain who was killed on 9/11. And these access points were what were originally used to be able to mount the operations in Afghanistan. There were a lot of things that went in this. The Rumsfeld article mentioned kind of stepping up to start providing military assistance to these host governments. That's everything from training to some weapon systems to contributions to their border security forces. There were a lot of promises and a lot of money that was promised to go in to try and urge these governments to help us, and they did. So in October 7th, is when Operation Enduring Freedom began. And the effort was originally primarily war airstrikes against Taliban forces in the north, as well as the insertion of special operations forces into Afghanistan from the north. They worked with the Northern Alliance. If any of you have a chance to watch the movie 12 Strong, I don't know if anybody has seen it. It's a good movie to watch because it talks about the early days of the operations in Afghanistan. And you'll see clips from Kashnikanabad Air Base where special forces were then deployed into northern Afghanistan to work with the Northern Alliance. And this is where you may recall Donald Rumsfeld talking publicly about how impressed he was by the so-called horse soldiers. And these were special operations forces who worked with the Northern Alliance and actually were on horseback with Northern Alliance fighters and calling in airstrikes and using laser designators to work against targets in Afghanistan. So ultimately, the Taliban regime unraveled after it lost Mazar Sharif, which is up in the north, north of Afghanistan, with the Northern Alliance forces. And by November 12th or so, the Northern Alliance forces had moved into Kabul, and we were off to the races, so to speak. So here was the challenge. You know, obviously, U.S. and coalition forces had ended up staying in Afghanistan for 20 years, and force levels increased and decreased based on the evolving strategies and political objectives, and that's also an entirely different topic, you know, to go into, which would take days to kind of break into its pieces and talk about. But I'm not going to go into those things too much, but let's fast forward to about the 2008 time frame. And that was right at the end of the Bush administration and the beginning of the Obama administration. And if you may remember, there were a lot of challenges coming from extremists, Al-Qaeda extremists operating in the tribal regions of Pakistan. And it was stymieing a lot of the stabilization efforts in Afghanistan proper. So discussions were kind of going on about whether, you know, we would have to take the fight to Al-Qaeda in those safe havens. And it was a serious challenge and a serious policy issue to start considering. But there was also a recognition that our logistical arrangements, our support for our forces, were brittle. So in this next slide, again, maps are critical on this. I want to highlight a couple of things. In 2008, because we had kind of hodgepodge things together over the prior years, we came to be very dependent on several key lines of what we call lines of communication into Afghanistan. The red lines that you see coming up from Karachi and heading north and going into two entry points into Afghanistan, those were our two primary ground routes to provide pretty much all of the heavy equipment, all of the heavy cargo that had to go into and out of Afghanistan was basically coming up through those two routes. The light blue line that runs from the Persian Gulf and then up over Pakistan, that was a primary air route that to support combat aircraft and refueling aircraft and personnel movements into Afghanistan, as well as you'll notice kind of a little small short line coming out of the Gulf under Pakistan. That was where aircraft carriers were stationed. So everything routed up over this corridor. It was called the Boulevard, and it was given to us, you know, or allowed by the Pakistanis to support the operations in Afghanistan. From the north, we really didn't have much. You'll see a light blue line there, and that was an air transit route. And that was primarily for things like generic cargo and personnel. And it would fly through the Caucasus, cross the Caspian Sea, gig up over to Kazakhstan, and then fly out to Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, to the Manas air base. And we use that to transload personnel, meaning American military personnel who were going into or out of Afghanistan. They would basically fly to the Manas Transit Center. They'd get off the aircraft. They'd spend a couple days there. And then they would be put on military aircraft to fly in the rest of the way into Afghanistan. And the reason why military aircraft is because they have protection systems on them, you know, to protect them from ground attacks or missile strikes and things like that. So obviously when you're carrying personnel in. The other mission we were doing from up there was air-to-air refueling, because air operations over Afghanistan for combat aircraft that had to come from the Persian Gulf and fly long distances or from aircraft carriers, by the time they got to Afghanistan, they were already, you know, needing fuel, and the refuelers would have to basically keep them topped up to be able to support operations that were happening on the ground. So these were very helpful things to have, but the logistical piece, the ground, the equipment and transit from Pakistan was, it became very quickly apparent that those were real vulnerabilities, and that our relations with Pakistan were so complicated, and their public discontent with what was happening in Afghanistan meant that any kind of event, you know, political decision overnight could lead to those supply lines being cut off. And if anybody's ever seen some of those famous graphics about Napoleon's army basically moving out to Russia, and then, you know, it goes out and the band is about this wide, and by the time it gets out to Russia, it's about this wide, and then by the time it's coming back, it's down to a trickle of nothing. Logistics really are critical considerations and things that people sometimes lose in the discussions about policy objectives, about strategy, obsession with kind of getting down into the tactics, in part because, well, for military people, it's fun and interesting. That's the engaging part of the business, but the logistics were an essential piece of this. So anyway, this is the challenge that we were faced with. And the vulnerability was something that we couldn't tolerate. And if you remember, that was right when Obama was moving ahead with the surge of forces into Afghanistan, again, trying to basically make the system work. The other thing that was going on, that was mentioned, as Pakistan was politically problematic. Central Asia was also not a particularly, you know, warm place to be, because we had spent a number of years really pressing those governments on human rights issues, in particular human rights reports, and beating up those governments on what was happening in the human dimension. And those were all critical issues. It was a national priority to try to advance human rights and democratization. But it was also kind of creating a sour taste in many of the Central Asian governments' mouths. They actually, in 2005, asked us to leave the air base in K2 in Kashni Khanabad in Uzbekistan. because we had criticized them about how popular uprising in Andijan province in the Fergana Valley had been squashed. So we did not have necessarily the most hospitable environment to walk into to ask for any favors. And that was the one problem. The second thing is Russia and China were really pressing on the Central Asians to kind of get the U.S. out of our backyard, get the U.S. out of these air bases. And they tried pretty hard to do it in 2009, right at the beginning of the Obama administration. The Kyrgyz told us, you need to leave Manas. At that point in time, it was playing a critical role in our operations, and we were able to save a deal with them. It cost us some extra money. We'd been paying about $17.5 million for access, which is a pretty good bargain for what we were getting. We ended up paying $60 million, came to an agreement for $60 million a year, but that was still saving us literally hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in additional costs to be able to maintain that access. So, it was still, though, an unfriendly environment. And these governments, we were feeling pressure from the Russians and the Chinese to say, to get us out. So what we ended up with then is saying, trying to surge forces, we need to come up with a different solution that's not as dependent on these other governments. First step is after we realized this had to be done, we really had to start figuring out how to get agreements to be able to do this stuff. And the first step in doing that was really trying to get agreement within the U.S. government that we needed to do it. They mentioned this interagency of state, NSC, intelligence community, all having varying equities that were legitimate equities that were on the table. We had to figure out how, are we going to do this and why does it have to be done? And the map that I showed you was an essential part of us trying to convince other parts of the government, the human rights community, very unhappy with the idea of us working more closely with the countries in Central Asia. And we had some pretty knockdown, drag-out fights over this. And there were a lot of concerns about, do we need to do this? There was first the question, what's really the risk, okay? And we had to explain, if you can't get in, the operations that we have going stop. And if the operations stop, then, the administration's effort to try and surge forces and fix the situation, that basically stops too. Would the governments be willing to help us? What do they want in return? What are the optics of working with some of these countries that have really questionable human rights records? How much is it going to cost us? Would the Hill support what we're trying to do? Capitol Hill is an important player in this whole process, very critical, and being able to engage with the Hill was one of the things we had to figure into our process. What level of U.S. officials would have to basically get these agreements? What about the potential risk that we'd be asking these governments to take, working more closely with us? Would that ramp up the pressure from Russia and China on them in ways that would hurt them and hurt our effort? And this wasn't an exhaustive list. So these questions and pushbacks continued pretty much over several years as the effort expanded. And these fights were primarily inside the confines of the U.S. government and in that smaller kind of cluster you would call the national security and foreign policy interagency process, where passions ran very high, arguments, multiple meetings at the White House with all the different agencies kind of fighting out their respective issues and trying to figure out what to do next. Anyway, it finally was realized the map made the argument, and it was something that I found that in the years that we were working this issue, I always had a fold-up map with me, basically a large foam-backed map board. And every briefing I would go to, it would go down on the table, and that's where we would start. Because usually what would happen is once you outline the situation, whether it was for Hill staffers, skeptical, you know, folks in other parts of the government, when they realized the physics and geography problem, they would go, yeah, we don't have much other choice than to support this. So it was clear then we kind of got agreement. We needed to do something about it. So of course, the first thing you do is you get an airplane. And that's it's a Gulfstream 5, by the way. It needed a delegation to go out and start, you know, preliminary discussions with these governments because nobody had actually talked to them yet. And I put up the airplane there because, again, defense diplomacy things, those airplanes mean something. They basically, they send a signal. They send a signal about the seriousness of the government. Most government people, most of the time, myself and all of us, would travel commercial air. The secretary travels in his own plane. The undersecretary gets his own plane. The combatant commanders, the four-star combatant commanders, they have their own aircraft. But the rest of us would fly in commercially. But in this particular instance, this was a symbolism issue. So we went in, and the first place we went to was, this is in Baku, Azerbaijan, which is right in the Caspian Sea. We visited the port facilities. The top picture there is the back end of what they call a roll-on, roll-off ship, where trains would basically, rail trains would fall into them, and they would go out to sea, and they'd cross the Caspian to Kazakhstan and then on. The other place we went was to Uzbekistan. There was a certain irony here. The picture that you're looking at, there are two pictures side by side. The first one is Soviet troops departing Afghanistan across the Friendship Bridge between Afghanistan and Uzbekistan in 1989. The other picture is when we were down there scoping out the same place for us to use for our logistic support. And I thought it was particularly ironic that we were, you know, down in the same place where they had been. It worked out. We basically were able to get these governments to agree with us, and some people had been very skeptical that they would. Why? Probably three reasons. The first one is that they really had legitimate concerns about regional security, about Afghanistan and destabilization. Second is they were looking for more normalized relationships with the United States, and maybe we could get away from constantly beating them up on issues they didn't want to hear about. And the third was possible business opportunities. Maybe they could make some money. So we ended up making agreements with countries along the routes here. What you now see in the red, the heavy red line going through the Caucasus, Kazakhstan, and down through Uzbekistan was a very active ground line of communication that carried significant amounts of cargo, you know, fuel, which when you're flying aircraft, you're burning 1 million gallons of fuel a week, and it's astounding numbers. Multiple rail cars, hundreds of containers of products coming in. The little red line that's coming down kind of from the north, we had for a short period of time, we had agreement from the Russians to be able to transit Russian territory. That was back during the Russia reset. So that was also a very efficient line that came from Riga, Latvia, and then came down through Russia into Afghanistan. And then you see the heavier blue lines. Those were now unrestricted air routes that would allow us to take all different types of cargoes into Afghanistan, and added the ability to transit over not just Kazakhstan, but also Uzbekistan, because it was a shorter route. So it was quite successful. In 2011, it turned out to be a really wise thing to have done, because the Pakistanis closed down ground lines of communication for about 6 months following an unfortunate incident where coalition forces and Pakistani Frontier Corps collided. 24 Pakistanis were killed, and they turned off our ground lines. But because of these logistical arrangements, we were actually able to sustain operations. And it was critical, again, having redundancy is critical. Where we're at today is obviously when we departed Afghanistan, a lot of those agreements kind of became invalid because they were linked to UN charter, UN resolutions, and NATO resolutions to support operations in Afghanistan. So those lines are gone now. But we still have to have access to the region for counterterrorism purposes and also for cooperation with these governments. But it's become a much more complicated environment, partly because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine has really changed the dynamics on the ground out there. So just very quickly, the takeaways from this is that absent, if you don't have something, a catalyzing event like we did on 9/11, military relationships have to be built and established well before we ever need them. You can't just go to the neighbor when your house is on fire and ask to borrow the hose. And introduce yourself at the same time. It just doesn't work. The other takeaway is physics and geography. Every time you look at where the United States is kind of currently engaging, think about how do we get there? How many other governments have to work with us or agree to support us to allow us to overfly their territory, to use their ports to be able to reach out? Third thing, defense diplomacy is not happening in a vacuum. It's basically a full spectrum of U.S. relations with foreign partners that we have to consider, and foreign partners have to basically be willing to absorb political risks. And lastly, you know, small investments in defense and security relationships can, you know, produce outsized benefits for us. And when you talk about resources, I'm going to fast forward to two slides, just put them up quickly, but I think it's important. When we start talking about money and resources, this is a pie chart for the 24 US government budget. I want you to look at that little red wedge, 1.4%. That's the US international affairs budget. That's all of State Department's budget, USAID, foreign military assistance, you know, things we call like security assistance money. That's all of it. And this last piece is of that money, that's how it's been divided up pretty much since 2001. Okay? So these are not big investments for the returns that you get, and they are things that are dictating kind of how well we can operate, providing us with essentially insurance policies to be able to do things we need to do.
Thank you, Clark. I think we'll run over for a few minutes here and take a few questions on it. I always start with my own question. You made it seem like, you know, Rumsfeld went over and it was so easy to get agreements with all these countries. Which countries were the hardest to deal with throughout this entire process?
I think I hate to categorize any of them as being particularly difficult. I think the place where we had some of the biggest challenges were in Uzbekistan. Because at the point of time we were doing these agreements, President Karimov, Islam Karimov, who had been essentially the president since Uzbekistan had become independent in 91, was still president and had developed a pretty rigid control over his government. And that made it a challenge in that in the way that no one was willing to talk or work with us until they had some sense that the president actually was going to support it. And you might imagine that creates a bit of a chicken and egg problem, because how do you know if their president is going to support it if he won't take a request from anybody other than our president? And that, as you might imagine, was one of the fights that had to happen about whether or not to invest President of the United States' capital, meaning the actual office and the importance of of him in the world, basically making a phone call to somebody who had a pretty bad human rights record. And the map helped make that argument as well. And it is a balancing off of priorities. You're sitting there saying we want to try and stabilize Afghanistan. At the same time, you know, you can't pick the neighborhood where you're operating in. And this one is a really bad and tough neighborhood. You know, you can't say, can we move Sweden and Germany and some other countries we like to work with, can we move them down there? You can't do it. So that was one of the hardest things. But in each one of these countries, one of the difficulties was in top-down systems where it's only surrounding with a president, you have to go to them to get a permission structure for the rest of the bureaucracy underneath them to actually start moving forward with any kind of substantive discussions. And on our side, people say, well, we don't want our president to call their president unless we know what the answer is going to be. And then you say, well, we can't get the answer. So these were some of the tensions we had to work with, but it was true in each one of these countries, and to go into the whys would be pretty exhausting. So okay, sorry.
No. So a number of questions here about, and I think the most general one is the one I read here. Did the U.S. have any negotiating chips other than money? I mean, what did we have to offer the stands and throughout all of this?
It's actually surprising because when push came to shove, it actually wasn't a lot of money. Money was not the big factor in it. It was political engagement and recognition. It was increased interactions between our governments. It was diversification of the issues that we were talking to them about that they also felt were beneficial, potential commercial opportunities, health issues, health assistance, agricultural assistance, a range of things that we would work with them on. So it really wasn't, we didn't give the Central Asians really a lot in terms of what you've seen in the budget numbers here, a very, very small amount of it. It was the political engagement, and it was the desire, as I think I mentioned in my points, it was the desire of the Central Asians to get back to a normal relationship with us. They wanted to have a little bit more of a multi-vector policy is what they call it, where they don't just have Russia and China telling, you know, everything, that's all we have to worry about. It's good to have a big friend like the United States to kind of offset some of that.
We have a huge number of questions here, and we've run out of time, actually. Ask one more question, and I think there are a number of them here that relate to that, and we all want to know. Why was the pullout from Afghanistan so disastrous? What went wrong? Are there any simple answers to this question?
This can get me in trouble in so many different ways. A couple comments. First, I think we need to keep in mind that one common feature from the Bush administration to the Obama administration to the Trump administration to the Biden administration, they all wanted out of Afghanistan in one way or another. And I mentioned in my remarks that there was this constant push and pull between do we surge forces, do we reduce forces, do we change our tactics, what are our objectives? So we had shifting policy objectives, we had shifting policy goals. So it was always something that wove throughout the entire kind of tapestry of our 20 years there was wanting to basically get away. And step back from it with hopefully a stabilized Afghanistan. The second thing is that retrograde movements from militaries are some of the most dangerous things you can do, and you know, and particularly in what's called a non-permissive environment, when you have people shooting at you and you start having to pull back, the enemy closing in on you, you don't have a whole lot of good options. And if you do remember, right before, at the end of the Trump administration, troop levels got reduced to about 2,500, which was not enough to really secure the airports that we needed to work out of. And President Biden was faced with, I think, an impossibly difficult decision about essentially putting troops back in to support a more orderly withdrawal, which would have then violated the agreement with the Taliban, which had prevented U.S. soldiers from being shot at for the prior 2 years. So it's, do I add troops and then start getting shot at again? And how do we work, or do we just try to do it cleanly? But I worked at my office. We had Afghanistan, Pakistan, Central Asia. All of us were working 24. We were working 24/7 shifts, basically, trying to deal with all of the people trying to get out, trying to get people through the gates in the Kabul airport. It was a pretty hard time for all of us, and for a lot of us who had worked the region for a long time, it was pretty hard to deal with. But could it have been done differently? Maybe on the margins, but I really think some things are just going to be, these kind of things are going to be messy. We didn't win the war.
Thank you.